Okay, I'm just going to start anyway. There's a few people in a bar, but I'm sure they'll make their way in here. Just to say a few things that some of you may have heard already. Peter Linebaugh's very kindly come over to speak at the Radical History Week. We did a talk yesterday, extremely interesting, about the Magna Carta. This afternoon he's going to be talking more in the theme of the Revolution Atlantic. And as I've mentioned already, there were a couple of books that were very influential in putting this week together. One of those books was The Many-Headed Hydra, which Peter co-wrote with Marcus Rediker. That book was very influential in making us think about this conference, not just in terms of Bristol history in a local sense, which I think we've covered quite a lot of, but also trying to look at how Bristol relates to the rest of the Atlantic as a port, and the relationship of trade in the British Empire in particular, obviously, with the movements of people and ideas and revolts and revolutions that occurred because of that. So the Hydra, I absolutely recommend that people read that book. We haven't got it here, which is because it's sold out. It's obviously a bit popular. And there is another book out there which Peter wrote called The London Hanged, which again I would definitely recommend if you want to understand how changes have occurred in capitalism in the 18th century. That's absolutely vital work. It sounds boring, but he writes brilliantly and anecdotally about some of the figures of the 18th century. So I would definitely recommend getting The London Hanged.
Boring.
Well, you know. Be realistic. Nobody picks up 400 pages of history and says, I'll read that. So I would definitely recommend picking that book. It's very easy to read and very, very interesting. London Hanged. Right, Peter is a professor at the University of Toledo. Now, I think, a bit of a fixture in the Bristol scene from the last couple of days he's been here. And I hope you enjoy his talk now. Just one thing, the BBC are here today to film. If you don't want to be filmed, right, then you could cause a bit of an insurrection now or something, but it's up to you. But obviously, if you don't want to be filmed, then I suggest that they will be filming some of the Q&A, I think, at the end of this. So if you don't want to be filmed, then just, I don't know, step behind them. But I would also like to say, that, again, and stress, this event has not been supported by any political parties, by any universities financially, any civic authorities. We have had no money from anybody, including, as yet, the BBC. So I would suggest that after this has been filmed, I know Hina's standing at the back here, and I'm sure she'd like to discuss with you about the nature of supporting events like this, as we do actually pay the licence fee for the BBC. So that should be something that I suggest all of you at the end, if you want to be negotiating as a mob about what we should be being paid for this event. And just to give you a quick idea, this event, the totality of the events for the whole week, cost £1,400 to put on, and most of that has come out of my wage packet, because I'm not a professional historian, or I'm not on a council gravy train to put events on or anything like that. Other people have put a huge amount of labour into this event for free, which I suspect is maybe what's going on with the BBC today. But if you want to negotiate at the end with the BBC, I suggest you do it en masse, and I'm sure they can sort it out for us. Thank you very much. Peter Linebaugh. Boring, boring. I've got some boring, boring.
No, that's the London Hanged he was talking about. And my mom found it very boring. She couldn't read it. She's passed now. I miss her, and I think of her every day. But she found it boring. But I was thinking, she couldn't read it. She couldn't read it. And I dedicated it to her. To her and to my dad. What? Yeah, the boring, huh? All right. Well, I want to live up to the expectations, so I'll have to try to add some footnotes and some obscure stuff and long quotations. What else? Facts and figures. It's all going to be boring. Yes, can we hear that? Boring, boring, boring. wouldn't be ragging on the BBC. Don't get me involved in that. Hey, why am I talking that way? Because I'm confused. My voices, my knowledge, my thinking comes from all over the place. All over these Atlantic mountains. That's where I'm from. And so thanks for those last words. You know, I'm feeling such great solidarity with Bristol here. And the Bristol Radical History Group. And I step outside there, you know, and the swans are bothering me. But I look at that bridge and I imagine what I've learned. I try to remember if I learned from the lecturer. And I look at the pictures and the artwork around, you know, and I am inspired by the multimedia. It's great. I've got the heat here and everything. It's really wonderful.
Get over it.
Boring. Yes. So I wanted to, Ian. I got some poetry here. We can definitely rag on that if you want, but still, I got to use it. But I was going on about the London Hang because Nicholas Frickman mentioned to me something beforehand, which I've got to get down to work. Well, first, I'm very sorry I missed his presentation. But Ruth told me he said something about a sailor who had a bonnet rouge, the red cap of liberty, tattooed on his chest. Was this right? And my co-worker, Marcus Rediker, gave me a coin before I came here that was minted by Thomas Spence. Where's Steve? Of a naked woman and a naked man dallying in Eden, or maybe just around the corner from him. But Blake used to read Milton with his wife naked in the backyard. Ah, there's an idea, huh? Okay. All right. Let's wait for the warmer weather. And then on the other side, there was a pig. And a pig, because of pig's meat. Remember, Edmund Burke referred to the people as the swinish multitude. So Thomas Spence and everybody else said, all right, we're the pigs. Oink, oink. And they had a laugh about it. And on his coin, he put a pig. And he called his newspaper Pig's Meat for the mass. And he had a pike on it, too, because the pike was the people's weapon, wasn't it? The pike, you could take off the pike head and it'd just be a stick. I think in Ireland they still keep the pike in the patch. But in England as well, in the 1790s, the pike was the people's weapon, and it was a Scotsman who went over to Paris to teach the use of the pike as a street weapon, as a people's weapon, as a type of... So you didn't have to have the money to buy the explosives. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. Can anyone help me? He taught the pikemen at the executions of Louis XVI. He's a Scotsman. He'd been to India. He'd been to Madagascar. He'd walked from India back to England through Kurdistan, and he camped. He's a vegetarian. They didn't call it that then, they called it Pythagoreans. Because evidently they believe, perhaps it's true, that Pythagoras himself did not eat other animals or living creatures. I'll remember his name before the day's out. But on top of the pike, on this coin, we're back at the coin, right? On the top of the pike, the pig, the pike, and on the top is the bonnet rouge. The bonnet rouge was the hat, the cap of freedom from Roman times. And then, I guess Nicholas explained it. Boring. Okay, just a big noise. It's going to have to be like this today, with different noises. Roger's wondering if I've totally lost it. Roger, I'm feeling the same. All right. Bristol and Bath Listen to my words. Hark! Hear the giants of Albion cry at night. We smell the blood of the English. We delight in their blood on our altars. The living and the dead shall be ground in our rumbling mills, for the bread of the sons of Albion, of the giant's hand and Schofield. Schofield and Cox are let loose. They accumulate the world in which man is by his nature the enemy of man. In pride of selfhood, unwieldy, stretching out into non-entity, generalizing art and science till art and science is lost. This is William Blake from Milton in 1803. And the rumbling mills are those dark satanic mills which began that famous poem. The Albion mills on the River Thames, you know, were powered by the steam engine, was destroyed by unknown saboteurs in 1791, the first steam engine in London, to make the bread. We don't think of London, I don't, as an industrial city, yet its forges and engineering works supplied the armaments for the wars on land and sea, the armaments used by the 100,000 of men and boys who were sailed to Haiti to crush the Haitian revolt that had begun in August 1791, that will mark them and mark this kingdom and mark Europe for centuries to come in unspeakable crimes which we've only in the last decades have begun to recognize. A trauma on this population and the population of these islands of large deaths, numbers of deaths, to suppress the first successful human slave revolution in world history. That begun in August 1791 in Haiti. Whose repression, the violence of its repression, the violence of its success, we still live with. The story of race and class must return time and time again to the Haitian revolt. It operates like a black hole in our universe that often can't be seen, but its magnetic field affects everything. So it's in London that the engineering works and forges produce the armaments. The mills ground the wheat to flour. But the year that Blake wrote was a year of dearth and shortages, and he fled. He fled to Feltham? F-E. What is it? Feltham. Feltham?
Feltham.
All right. And there, he got bothered by a veteran, a returning veteran. Perhaps the guy was still trigger happy. Perhaps he believed what he'd been taught. But he wanted some work in Blake's front garden, and Blake wouldn't give it, and they began to exchange words. And according to this guy, Schofield, or Cox was his name, Blake damned the King of England, his country and his subjects, and his soldiers were all slaves, and all the poor people in general were slaves. These were the words which this veteran of wars, not having got a job from, testified that Blake had said, and as a result, Blake was tried for treason. The jury let him off. The story is important to me, not just to explain the words that I read before, but Blake saw that tyranny existed not just above, not just in the kings, but it exists in our class as well. And Blake is dealing with that. He's confronting that. The relations of domination and cruelty and violence, which start from above, affect below and become part of us and part of our class. the bully, the tavern bully, the swaggering veteran. It's no accident that just as Bush sends troops to Mesopotamia, he also closes the hospitals for veterans at home. Capitalist accumulation based on competitive individualism, an egotism that is so great as to dissolve in cosmic imperialism, and as a process of scientific generalization based on empirical philosophy. These are some of the targets that Blake has in 1803. And he contrasts this with the minute particulars and the mutual forgiveness to be found within the labor process, to be found within actual, real relations between human beings, such relations as Melville was describing. And all the arts of life, they change into arts of death in Albion. This is Blake, and it is in my mind too. It's a civilization that rules by death. It's a civilization of hanging. I mean, we all know the story of the wrecked sailor who foundered at sea until he saw land, and then on land he saw a gallows, and thank God that he was in a Christian country. These arts of death, where do you go with that? Well, with the London hands. 30,000 were condemned to death between 1770 and 1830 in England. 30,000 by judicial process, and 7,000 were hanged. This is state terror, public terror. It affects us, it affects our memories, it affects our children, it affects the widows who are left behind, it affects the families, and it lasts deeply and long, as surely as famine, as surely as war. In the London Hang, I coined an idea of the thanatocracy, which is just a way of trying to explain ruling by death. The ruling class wishes to say that it rules by life. Remember, Malthus wishes to preserve life, but he needs death to organize that life, to organize exploitation. And he starts to study death. It's in this context that I think that our theme of race and class, which was so powerfully presented to me last night at the Cube, as I hear a city grappling with this issue that has riven people for centuries, without answers, with passion, with knowledge, and trying to use the best of our past. And to me, it's a continuation of the discussion that Blake was initiating. I speak strongly about it with gratitude because in the country where I come from, in the Great Lakes, fear rules us and fear holds our tongue in this time of war and terror. So this is why I'm just so grateful to be here for this Bristol Radical History meeting. I've got to look at my papers. There's on the arts of death, what I might, I'm not too sure how to approach and our discussion. Can I just ask you a quick question? How many people know the many-headed hydra in this room? How many people have had a look at it? Okay, I might say one thing about it by and by. It comes to an end in the early 19th century. It comes to an end very much in the period of the revolutionary Atlantic, where a great, powerful... Okay. Here's a quotation I'd like to read. No, in fact, I promise quotations and facts and figures. And here is a quotation from 1786 from Reverend Joseph Townsend, who wrote a dissertation on the poor laws. Hunger will tame the fiercest animals. It will teach decency and civility. Obedience and subjection to the most perverse. In general, it is only hunger which can spur and goad the poor onto labor. Yet our laws have said they shall never hunger. The laws, it must be confessed, have likewise said they shall be compelled to work. But then legal constraint is attended with much trouble, violence, and noise, creates ill will, can never be productive of good and acceptable service, whereas hunger is not only peaceable, silent, unremitting pressure, but as the most natural motive to industry and labor, it calls forth the most powerful exertions. This is a spokesperson from the English elite at the end of the 1780s, describing the advantages of dearth and starvation. Here are some of the arts of death: war, starvation, hanging. These are the sources which the rulers of the Atlantic apply for the creation of terror. Isn't that amazing? Did that quotation sink in? Okay. I wanted to mention that. I told Roger, he asked me what's the title of my talk, and I said I'd like to call it A Spot in Time. And the spot in time that I would choose would be the 2nd of April, 1792, for another date. I think we have two dates or three dates now. This date, the 2nd of April, 1792, I guess there's four things that I'd like to say about it. And here, Roger, this is academic as all get out. I mean, to string everything around one date and one time. But I'm going to do it anyway. It's just the way my mind works. On the 2nd of April, William Pitt, the Prime Minister, stayed up all night in the House of Commons giving an oration, which is still in elocution books, on why it's such a good idea to abolish the slave trade. And the House of Lords then put the word gradually into the motion. But the motion was defeated later. But he stayed up all night on the 2nd of April, and this was supposed to be a very glorious moment in the English upper class history on doing that humanitarian thing. And they praised themselves very much. And for us now, when we read it, we just automatically remember the French expression, perfidious Albion. Because all of this eloquence prepared the way for the massive exploitation of slave labor for the next several decades. It's not going to be a vote in the House of Commons, is it? But it's going to be Bush's rebellion in 1817, or the Damara revolt in 1823, or the revolt in Jamaica in 1831 that will put an end to slavery. The second thing that happened on the 2nd of April 1792 is that the London Corresponding Society announced itself to the public as a corresponding society for the reform, the democratic reform of Parliament, and for the abolition of slavery. And it did so in a society where members were unlimited. A democratic meeting where you didn't have to pay at the door, or you didn't have to arrive in a carriage or in an SUV, what have you. You know, when Cheney went to the Capitol Hill last month to bend the arms of the congressmen to get rid of habeas corpus, he went with 25 SUVs. The man cannot show himself in public. The traffic must stop. No, I start thinking from facts like that. They're worried. What are they worried about? They're worried about our Hades. They're worried about our class. Well, the London Corresponding Society, I guess, the ancient and venerable story in England is that the working class was formed because of it, partly because it linked the artisans of London with its tradition of the mob and the constitutional doctrines of the freeborn Englishman with the new industrial proletariat to be found in Sheffield, with the Sheffield steel workers, the coal workers, and the scissors grinders. And it was this link. Of course, as we've explained elsewhere, the Sheffield workers and the London artisans got to know each other thanks to a Nigerian. Olaudah Equiano got them in touch with one another, just as he had spent 9 months in Ireland, in Belfast, in Cork, and in Dublin, just as he had been in Scotland. I'm presenting him as an Atlantic figure, as an Atlantic mountain, who brings notions of habeas corpus, of liberty, of trials, of punishment only with trials beforehand. He brings these notions from his own struggles on shipboard during the 1760s and 1770s, when he was a 20-year-old, strong, hearty, and hale. Those were his experiences of freedom. Those were his experiences which recalled to him habeas corpus. You don't detain the body without cause shown, without process of law. So this man, who begins his autobiography, who's read it? The autobiography of Olaudah Equiano, published in a current edition by Penguin, and in press now, in paperback. Who's read it? Every single one of us must read this. I am cross. It's not just that there'll be a test. When I return, I expect Olaudah Equiano to be on every working person's shelf. And if you're not interested, you must read it to your children, because it is more exciting as a sea tale, as an adventure story, than Robinson Crusoe, You know, or what else do you have over here? Or what's that? What's his name? Woodus Rogers or Dampier? Well, Lauda Equiano beat them all, and I'm sure he was in Bristol. So Bristolians, let's read O Lauda Equiano. It's part of our history here. It's part of the history of Ireland. It's part of the history of Scotland. It's part of the history of our class. It's also part of the history of our race. O Lauda Equiano writes at a time before Dr. William White up in Manchester went poking around the hospitals in the same year, 1791, 1792, looking for the indigenous black people in order to take off their clothes and to measure her breasts. Yes, Mr. Dr. William White, a founder of physical anthropology and racism in Europe and in world history. At this same time, do you follow me? There's a debate about what kinds of human beings, what kinds of men and women do we want to become? This is the issues that are being discussed in the 1790s. You know the vast terror that I tried to evoke, you know, the starvation, the hangings, the war. It's because there are people around the planet, or certainly around the North Atlantic basin, who are willing to climb mountains, these Blakean Atlantic mountains, to create a new kind of human being. And racism, classism, speciesism are introduced to chop up that hope. This is a spot in time. On the 2nd of April, 1792, third thing that happened on that fact that day, the French Revolutionary Assembly abolishes the color line for citizenship. It's not pie in the sky that we're talking about. This is revolution, and people are thinking. Do you follow me? Even in the USA, which is a fiction of imperial genocide, you know, we have the slogans on the streets now, sometimes in America, is stop the invasions, end the stop the occupations of Gaza or Palestine or Iraq or the future ones possibly of Iran or Colombia. And now you sometimes can hear, end America. Get the USA out of America. It reminds us of something, of that spot in time when governments are made and unmade by the people or by different forces. And in 1791 and 1792, this was a spot in time when people were debating this, just as surely as they debated on the ship, how to run a ship, or at the market during a food riot, how to market food. Man, that got heavy. Yeah, I shouldn't start out a talk about on the arc of death, you know? That should be in the middle somewhere. Because there's death around us. And, you know, I mentioned yesterday, and I want to mention again right now, the name of Peter Fryer, who died last Tuesday. An Atlantic mountain. You remember him. When it was 1948 with the Empress Windrush, Peter Fryer, what was the communist newspaper called? No, before the Morning Star. The Daily Worker, thank you. He was a journalist for them. He had been a sailor for all. No, we can wait. We've waited a long time. And we can keep waiting. Our time's coming. That's what I think. anyway, I wanted to express condolences, you know, with the Bristol Radical History Group for Peter Fryer and his great study of the history of black people in England. Who knows it? Good. These are advanced students. It's a great book, isn't it? And I think there's an edition in the back still. Do we still have one? Steve? Sold out, but it's still in print. Staying Power, A History of Black People in England. It's a great book. Yes. Where was I? Stay away from... Oh, the Arts of Death. We want to stay away from that. Yeah, but, you know, it's hard to. It's very hard to. I have this... Okay, let's have a spot of theory. All right? In Bristol, we can do theory. Yeah? Okay, let's go to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There's the brains, you know, Wittgenstein. Weren't they from there? This fell apart. Two of them came over to England, in London. Then during the war, during the Blitz or whatnot, they put their thinking cap on and did a bit of theory, a spot of theory. I'm referring to Friedrich von Hayek, The Road to Serfdom, 1944. This is such a major book for the neoconservatives of the United States, the folks who brought us the war in Mesopotamia, the folks who are bringing us privatization as the answer to all questions. Von Hayek and the commodification of the whole world and the exchange, free trade exchange of all relations is von Hayek's theoretical contribution. At the same time, another theorist, 1944, also from the Hungarian Empire, Karl Polanyi, right? Writes The Great Transformation, 1944. Excellent book. This isn't that theoretical. It's not really a theory. It's more like books, like bibliography. I often get them confused. Polanyi takes the self-regulated market and the consequent or subsequent transformation of society as nothing less than the institutional separation of society into an economic and political spheres. Like to him, this is cutting the human race in twain to separate politics from economics. Then he said that the biggest fiction is the labor market. And Polanyi doesn't even like the word labor. He thinks it's a capitalist term for the, it's another word for the forms of life of common people. How do we as commoners live? That's our question now. How are we going to live without exploitation? And Polanyi is saying, we don't need the word labor for that, or to organize all of human life as a question of labor power, of buying and selling us, of the labor market, this basic class issue. No, he's saying, what is our life? What life do we want? How do we want to live? And what he calls in the 1790s, the great transformation, is turning our life into a commodity to be bought and sold. Nice. Okay, that end of books, end of Austro-Hungarian Empire theoretical gesture. But I wish to contrast the neoliberalism of today to Polanyi, to other conceptions of human life. All right. Yeah, I was going to just talk about 5 people who were hanged not counting Disbarred. Who heard the Disbarred talk last week? Okay. Yeah, Disbarred was an Irish insurrectionist. He was a member of the United Irishmen, and who wished to overthrow the British Empire, and may have had a go at it. He needed, I think he said, Steve, how many did he say that he needed to take a city? Yeah, I think you said 8,000. I need 800, or I think, to take a city. So he had begun thinking about this, you know, as a practical matter. How to take the tower, how to take the mint, how to take Parliament, how to take Windsor Castle, which he wanted to turn into an orphanage.
Can we talk about that now?
Well, I think there's a difference here between how do we live, whether we're going to take power, or whether we're going to live with it. His concept was the city. You take the city, and you take the money, the source of the money, the source of power, and the source of the magic. You know, the king, the arms, the mint. That was his concept of urban insurrection. And it was been a concept of many, right? And the history of urban insurrection as a means of combating capitalism was definitely a strategy of a venerable duration. But as we look at Baghdad now, attempts at insurrection there, as we look at the history of insurrections or at Oaxaca, or at the history of insurrections in Central America in the 80s, it's no longer quite the thing. You know, just as the Blanquiste did it, the insurrectionaries deriving from the French Revolution, or from the Gordon Riot, let's put it that way. Was part of the program to open the prisons? Was part of the program to take down the fences? Was, you know, how, in taking the city, how is the nation, is the country to bouleverse? Does that mean turn it upside down? Does it? Maybe not. Okay, I'll stay away from that. It's a French thing. But the guy Disbarred was an insurrectionist, and this was his notion. But he had also traveled in the industrial districts. His wife, as you know, Catherine, was from Jamaica or South Carolina, was a person of color. She also belonged to the United Irish. She, after he was hanged in 1803, she returned to Ireland. How did she help Robert Emmet in the summer of 1803 before Emmet's rising in October remains an open question. She is an Atlantic Mountain. By here, an Atlantic Mountain is someone who has experiences in two or three parts of the liberation struggle of the North Atlantic, like you were saying Melville did, except with Melville, we had the Pacific. And we can do that in the 1790s as well, with Fletcher Christian, with the bully Bligh, with the struggle with those mutinies, the attempt to get breadfruit from the Pacific to be grown in the Caribbean to feed the slaves. That's the bounty. That's why Captain Bligh is a tyrant. To reorganize the global food industry, to reorganize the reproduction of the slavery in the West Indies. Oh man, this is going all over the place. Fair enough though, this is the way, here in Bristol, we're all part of going all over the place, right? I mean, you're stepping over there on the quay, on the cobblestones right behind us. They say this is a wharf. You imagine the people. Where are the people coming from all over the world? What do they bring? I show up here. I find out that the Bristol Football Club, or some of its members anyway, go up to Oaxaca. And it was Oaxaca that really changed me, because it was out of the indigenous people's struggle that they said, what about Magna Carta? And I didn't know. And that was yesterday's talk. But in other words, I'm saying that our knowledge comes from all over the place. And the nationalist, the racist divisions among us prevent us from seeing that. And we are spun yarns and lies about our bodies, which are mutilated to cause these lies. Do you follow me? This great book, you know, I've just started reading it, about how rape is the beginning of imperialism. And again, I want to put a plug in for Silvia Federici's book on the Caliban in the back, because this is the book that those of us who come from a Marxist tradition, we generally think that it's the expropriation of the land that begins capitalism. She shows definitively that it's the expropriation of the uterus that begins the capitalism, primary accumulation. It's a fantastic book, beautifully illustrated. But please, let me get back. I was going to talk about Thomas Heliker in 1803, the Trowbridge man. Is that right? Is that far from here? No. Okay. Good. I wanted to put him in because he destroyed a full England scribbling mill. He had nothing to do with the machine repression of commoners, of common people. He was a Froom cropper in 1802, a trade unionist. And it was a resolution throughout England, Scotland, and Ireland not to work after machinery. Thomas Heliker, and he was hanged in 1803. Do you follow this? Scotland, Ireland, England, the croppers anyway, are working on the basis of a new humanity. They are not going to be divided by bigotry, religion, sectarianism, which the British state, in forming the United Kingdom, which perhaps is every bit as much of a fiction as the USA, in 1801, to make a division between the English struggle, the Irish struggle of working people. That's why Heliker was hanged. Hannah Smith hanged in Manchester. For what? Highway robbery. What was the highway robbery? She had some butter. She took some butter. She didn't even have it for herself. She sold it at decent prices that working people and working housewives of Manchester could afford. It's not just butter, by the way. She also took some milk and some potatoes. There was a food riot on the basis of a moral economy. You know, it wasn't cute just stealing. It wasn't even desperate starvation, I must eat. It was, this is the way buying and selling must be done. And she was hanged for it. They call that the moral economy. 1800, Gabriel Prosser. 6'3", broad, is hanged along with 35 others in Richmond, Virginia. He refused to confess to his interrogator, James Madison. Who is James Madison? He's the guy who wrote the USA Constitution. That's the Constitution that makes slaves, that makes African Americans 3/5 of a human being. Read that Constitution of the USA, and you can see why some of us are shouting, USA out of America. You follow? It's not. Yeah, I shouldn't. I'm just trying to. I'm being provocative, you know. Because back to Melville. Melville wrote before the Civil War, and the Civil War resulted in great amendment changes to the USA Constitution, abolishing slavery, for instance. Not quite done, the 13th Amendment, because it permits slavery for prisons. Anyway, Gabriel Prosser also hanged, 1800. For a slave revolt, examined by James Madison, and he answers, I have ventured my life in endeavoring to obtain the liberty of my countrymen. He too is propelled by the events in Haiti of 10 years earlier. And at that time, because Haiti will get its independence in the year that Despard is hanged. In 1803. Sarah Lloyd, a serving girl, is hanged in Bury St. Edmund the same year for stealing a watch. She'd been seduced by a plumber. The plumber asked her, "What can you get?" Well, she got a watch from her mistress. She was defended by Cathal Loft. Who knows him? I don't know him either. I want to read him. Steve, you must know him. Cathal Loft, we need to know him. We must bring him back. He was a member of the Anti-Slavery Society. He went with Sarah Lloyd to the gallows in the tumbrel, holding on an umbrella for her, because it was a rainy day. And he went up on the gallows stage and stood next to her for support, Cathal Loft, and said, while he was up there, "The rich have everything, the poor nothing." And she held back her hair because the hangman had faltered. Because it's not natural to kill someone. She was helping him out. I think there's a story about Richard Parker too, isn't there, that way? That he jumped into the sea to his death so that none of his comrades on the ship would have to live with the fact that they had hanged him. Do you follow? I mean, it's much harder to live with having killed. And anyway, Sarah Lloyd. So I wanted to touch on the themes of reproduction, on the themes of servitude, on the themes of slavery, on the themes of mechanization, in my choices of those four or five people who were hanged. Because I think Despard had a good idea, the United Irishmen had a good idea, having been defeated in 1798. And I really must stop here for a minute and just remind us here in Bristol how very important, you know, as we look at Ireland from here, the intimate relationship between Bristol and Ireland in our history, that it is Ireland that mediates the relationship with the Caribbean. That the racism, the prejudices, the bigotries, or you will know, I might speak in too easy generalities, but the tensions within our working class with Ireland are parallel to the tensions and the divisions between white and black, historically. But historically, beginning in the 1790s, you might wonder, why is Belfast not a slave port? Why Liverpool? Why not Belfast? It's because the Belfast... Well, I was going to say the Belfast workers, but what I'm sure of is that the Belfast United Irishmen refused, and the merchants of Belfast refused that, anyway. I'm trying to put a word in for this spot in time. I'm trying to put a word in for what Edward Thompson used to call human agency. That this world we have around us can change. And it's us who can do it. It's us who are doing it. This was very much with the United Irishmen. Just as it was with Tacky in the revolt of 1760, which prepared the way for the American War of Independence. Just as it was in the minds of the Haitians. Did I quote already that the stone that the builders rejected shall become the cornerstone? Did I quote that? That's Olaude Equiano. He's quoting scriptures. But those who are least, there will be such great creativity from our struggle. Wow, I'm just preaching. I gotta be cooler, man. That could be enough. But I could go, May I just pause? Oh, I know, I was going to say about Ireland. Many of the United Irishmen, the terror in Ireland was far greater in the summer of 1798 than the terror in France in 1794. Far greater, in terms of numbers killed. Many of the Irish were shipped off to the West Indies, where, in Jamaica, we read from Castlereagh's letters, they joined the slaves as Maroons in the hills. That's something, eh? In other words, those stories, that mixture of race and class that we were dealing with last night, this is not the first time that we, as people, have had to deal with that. The previous time was in the 1790s. And it happened on the ground. And it's war and terror that causes it. And the opposite to war and terror is peace and commoning. And that peace and commoning was not romantic pie in the sky. People were fighting and living and dying for it. Do you follow me? Oh, I feel myself yelling. And I would like to come down. And I don't, okay. I think I've spoken of some Atlantic mountains, haven't I? Of some people from Bristol to Jamaica to Haiti to Boston to New York to Belfast to Dublin. We're part of it. And we hear one another and we learn from... Okay, enough. Questions? Yeah? Or let's have a bit of a... Can we do that? Yeah? All right? All right, then. All right. Facts?
Theory.
Dates? People?
Yeah. Football.